The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by MECU, Baltimore's credit union, and the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome today. We're going to have a number of things to do in the next 2 hours. We'll be talking with Hala Esfandiari, who wrote the book My Prison, My Home, One Woman's Story of Captivity in Iran. You remember, she was the woman who, American, who was kept in an Iranian prison, caused a huge stir just before this election. And then we'll be talking in the next hour with Ben Jealous, president of the NAACP and others, about race in America. So stay with us for that. But on your way to listening and participating, let's get you home safe and turn this over to WEAA Traffic. I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. We're going to spend the hour talking with our guest, Hala Esfandiari, who wrote the book My Prison Home, One Woman's Story of Captivity in Iran. You remember this story in December 2006 when she was driving home, what she thought was a normal day, from the airport in Tehran, where she goes every year to visit her mother. She was stopped by a group of what she thought was thugs, ended up being stuck in Iran till September of 2007. And she was put in prison for that time and had a harrowing experience in that period of time. And we're going to talk this hour about the state of Iran and the state of what happened to her. When it happened to her, she was 67 years old. And she is the director of Middle East programs at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. And Hala Esfandiari, welcome. It's good to have you with us.
Thank you very much, Mark.
It's an honor to have you on the show.
Pleasure to be with you.
Thank you so much. So it, when I read this book, I mean, we all in America obviously knew the story, followed it as it was going on, and no one can ever really comprehend what another human being goes through when they are stuck in a situation like yours. But the idea of being, we're close to the same age, but the idea of being stuck in a country you're going back to visit your mother, and then being put in prison at the last minute, being charged with a conspiracy to overthrow the government with a little help from the United States of America, was just astounding. I mean, I think of the kind of harrowing thoughts were going through your mind when it all erupted.
You know, when I was first stopped at the airport and robbed, I thought this is an ordinary robbery, which happens in every big city, and Tehran is a city with almost 15 million inhabitants, so it can happen. But then very soon I found out that this was not your ordinary robbery, and this was the action of the intelligence ministry. And basically they kept me under country arrest for 8 months, of which I spent 105 days in solitary confinement in Evin prison, which is quite well known around the world for having tortured people, for people having killed there, people having spent years and years there. So it was a frightening experience, really.
And you left Iran what year?
To come
to the United States.
States. I left Iran in 1978, but didn't come directly to the United States. I spent a year in England and then came to the United States.
And your husband is also Iranian, but he's Jewish and you're a Muslim.
Yes.
Which was, even in the time when the many different cultures of Iran lived together in relative peace. And there was, as you write about, a great deal of tolerance that lived in Iran in that period. It was still a very odd marriage for that society.
Yes, don't forget that we are now both. My husband is 72, and I'll be very soon 70. So when we got married, 45 years ago, this was not a very common thing to do. But then gradually there were a lot more of intermarriages between different faiths, Christian and Muslims in Iran and Jews and Muslims. But after the revolution, this was completely more or less forbidden.
Now, I want to go backwards a little bit to your growing up in Iran. I was really fascinated by the beginning chapters in your book leading up to what happened to you when you went back to visit your mother, who in fact is Austrian.
Yes.
But lives in Tehran, where you grew up. And I was thinking about the way different women I've read who have lived in pre-revolutionary Iran describe that country, describe that society, but I'll come back to that in a minute. I want to talk about what happened to you. So you, for our listeners who know this story maybe cursorily, who have not yet read the book, you go to Iran every December, every Christmas, to visit your mother. This was like every other year you've ever done this.
Sure.
Did you have any expectations at all that this was going to happen to you?
No, because I had been going back more than once a year. I'd been going back 3 to 4 times a year to visit my mother, to spend weeks with her in Iran, because she was in her 90s and it was very difficult for her to travel. So I would go back to Iran, spend some time with her, look into her affairs, and then come back. And I never encountered any problem. And therefore, this came to me as a shock, and I was taken aback. And I was very careful in my trips to Iran, especially since President Ahmadinejad became president, because I knew that the intelligence ministry was growing in its... the power of the intelligence ministry was growing, and I just didn't want to get into any kind of trouble which will jeopardize my trips to Iran.
And when these thugs attacked, and turned out really not to be thugs at all, but thugs for the government, I should say.
Sure.
You were soon visited by the intelligence authorities and appeared this man whose name was Jafari.
Yes. First of all, it turned out later on I concluded that the people who stopped my car and attacked us were members of the intelligence ministry. And secondly, when I went to apply for my passport and I was asked to meet with a passport official, the kind of questions this guy, Mr. Jafari, was putting to me was not the kind of your regular, ordinary questions. He started asking me about my husband. He said, "Is it true that your husband is Jewish?" And that was very odd. And he wanted the name of my grandchildren, who were then 6 and 4. And what was my salary at the Wilson Center? So these were very odd questions. And he was not at all interested in the story of the robbery.
And it was clear, it was at that point, looking at those parts of your book, that this began to dawn on you that something else terrible was about to happen, that they kept coming back, he kept coming to your home, he kept calling you in for these interviews.
Yeah. They started calling me in to what they called a passport office for a couple of weeks, and then they really moved me to the intelligence ministry for my interrogation. And that was a horrible place because, you know, you went in and you were at their mercy, and the door would just shut after you. And unless they unlocked the door, you couldn't go out. And the interrogation became much more threatening, and it was quite a harrowing experience. I would be under interrogation 8 hours a day, 9 hours a day. I would go in the morning and come back in the early evening, and the distances were great. And, you know, it was winter and it was cold and it was dark and all these things. But the pressure on me was terrible. They just wanted to know why, what the United States had planned for Iran, and I would have been the last person to know about the United States plans for Iran.
And I mean, reading the things you wrote, like this time when they came to you and you were thinking about would you ever see your Shawl, your daughter Hale, your grandchildren. And you said you suddenly heard Shawl, as you write, my pillar of strength in difficult times, and his familiar quote-unquote, pull yourself together, Plums. You swallowed the lump in your throat and rang the doorbell. How difficult that must have been, even before you were put in prison. I mean, it's just the anxiousness of knowing that could happen at any moment.
You know, if I had read enough about the Iranian intelligence ministry to know how sinister these people are. And so every day when I went for interrogation, I wasn't sure whether they will let me go back home or they will even keep me in the ministry, because again, I had heard that they had cells in the intelligence ministry and also in apartments around the city where they would keep people in prison. So, but really, as long as I was going and coming, I was allowed to go home at night. There was always the comfort of being able to call Shaul, my husband, to call, to speak to my daughter, to speak to my sister. And also because they were asking questions about the Wilson Center, so I could get information from my colleagues at the Wilson Center, either directly or through Shaul. But I was worried that once they incarcerate me, that's it, I'll be cut off from the rest of the world.
And I think, do you have some water? Are you okay?
I'm okay.
Okay, good.
Thank you.
Wish you were in my studio, then we could give you a glass of water.
No, I have a glass of water. Thank you.
When you were finally put in that prison, when they led you up those steps, and you made a very bold and brave decision to stop thinking about your family, to stop trying to think about your husband, your daughter, your grandchildren, to give yourself some strength to get through this, because you had no idea what might happen, whether it was going to be torture, whether you could be murdered, whether you would be harmed in some other way. You just had no way of knowing.
Sure. First of all, you know, I was taken by surprise when they showed me a piece of paper telling me that this is my arrest warrant. You know, I just didn't believe it. Although I had a premonition, and the night before I had sent an email to my husband saying that I think they will take me in. But when they took me to Evin and they told me, stand and face the wall, and the next thing I knew there was a woman guard who came and put a blindfold around my eyes and said, hang on to my hand and I'll take you to your cell. This was a terrible moment. You know, it is not only you feel disoriented, but you feel humiliated. You feel like a child. You know, you hear footsteps, but you don't know where they come from. It's an unfamiliar territory, your terrain. You don't know whether you're going to hit your head on the ceiling or whether you will fall down the stairs. So, you know, I was led by this woman two flights up and then through probably several corridors to the women's ward.
And then there was this officer who became one of your interrogators, maybe the main one, Haj Agha.
That's right.
And go ahead, yeah. I'm sorry.
Yes, because outside prison, I had just Jafari as my interrogator, and we could sit face to face, and he would ask questions, and I would answer him. But in prison, his boss came, and I talked to him twice outside prison on the phone, you know, when he had called in and said how dissatisfied there are they are with my answers. So when they took me again blindfolded for interrogation in prison in a small cell and told me to sit and face the wall, and then Haj Agha came in and he said, well, we warned you that we would take you in, and you know, now you don't have a place to go, so you are going to come out straight and answer all our questions.
But their questions, I mean, the way you describe their questions in your book, whether it's before you were arrested, after you were arrested, after you were freed, until you were able to leave Tehran and come back to America, were Kafkaesque, were just, like as you put in one of your chapters, like the theater of the absurd. I mean, they made no sense.
Exactly. First of all, their tactic is to repeat the same question over and over, and you answer them orally, and they make you write these answers also. And then they get back to the same questions 3 days later, 5 days later, just to catch your discrepancies, to see whether you made a mistake or you are saying something else. And then based on that, they say, okay, we got you. But the whole, you know, Mark, the whole accusation, the reason of my being interrogated and taken in was really absurd, because they thought I'm part of a plot to overthrow the Iranian regime. And at some stage, I even thought to myself, look, I mean, I'm 67 years old. I am barely 5 feet tall. I weigh 105 pounds. How can I overthrow this the mightiest regime in the region? This is really ridiculous. But they truly, truly believed, and they had convinced themselves that there is a plot to overthrow the regime. And if I was not a mastermind, they thought I'm the big fish which they arrested.
What do you attribute the absurdity of the notions that come out of these the parts of the Iranian government, whether it's what happened to you when you were imprisoned and kept in Iran for 9 months, or whether it was not in prison for 9 months, but not allowed to leave Iran for 9 months, or whether the accusations of Ahmadinejad now and the others, for the students who revolted. I mean, where does it come from? What's the derivation of this kind of almost strange, Kafkaesque kind of thinking?
Yeah. The way they explained it to me is that the United States and Iran have been enemies for the last 30 years. The United States has been trying to undermine the regime, to overthrow the Iranian regime. And since it is bogged down in Afghanistan and in Iraq, it cannot afford another military strike on yet another Islamic country, and also it will not, it does not have the means to do a surgical strike. Therefore, they will try and undermine and overthrow the regime through a soft revolution, just like what had happened in the Ukraine and in Georgia. And I got a sense that they were, in, you know, either had studied very carefully what had happened in Georgia and in the Velvet Revolution in Czechoslovakia, the Orange Revolution in the Ukraine, the Rose Revolution in Georgia, and they thought that the United States is using the same methods to create such a regime change in Iran.
One of the going backwards for a moment in your book, there's a short piece when you come out of the when you're let to go home back to your mother's house after their interrogation one evening. You couldn't find a cab, and you found this cab driver who turned out to be an educated man who was also a fireman. And I found the juxtaposition of his ideas kind of really telling about society in Iran today. And can I just read this paragraph, and you can just talk about it for a minute?
Sure.
You write that you would talk to him about how dangerous it must be for him to be a firefighter. And this cab driver said to you, living in Tehran is more dangerous. It's like living in a burning hell. You face death 20 times a day, driving a cab in this traffic in your home, or coming face to face with revolutionary guards, the morals police, the Basij, the paramilitary force in Iran. As to work, once in a while there's a fire and we have to go and extinguish it. At least that job is rewarding and you help people. So the madness of living in this society the way it is one thing. But then he goes on to say to you later about why he doesn't want to get married. He says, women no longer know their place. They have disoriented us men too. They're taking our place everywhere, in the universities, the ministries, and on the streets. Wherever you turn, there are aggressive women ready to push you aside. You are lucky if they don't trample you under their feet. That to me kind of spoke wildly about all the contradictions facing this society in Iran today.
Sure, because for the last 30 years, women have been the only group in the society, and of course the younger generation who have been standing up to the government. And in standing up to the government and in reaching out for their rights, of course they trample over other people's rights. And the men feel that they are being pushed aside because, look, 65% of students at the universities are now women. I mean, it got so to such an extent that Parliament was going to suggest the quota system in favor of men at the universities. So you have the women are more educated and the women seek out better jobs. Whether they get it or not is a different story. And the women speak out their mind. And so a young man like this cab driver who grew up in a very traditional family is not necessarily used to being facing such aggressive women who go after their rights.
We're talking with Hala Esfandiari, who is author of the book, her latest book, My Prison, My Home, One Woman's Struggle of Captivity in Iran. And you remember her story that hit the press in America in 2007. Every year she would go home to visit her mother in Iran, in Tehran. And that year in 2006, she was not allowed to leave. They had her passport. She was stuck in Iran. Then they put her in prison for 105 days. Is that right? Do I have that right?
Yes.
105 days.
You have that right.
And not allowed to leave Iran until September of 2007. And she is also director of the Middle East program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in Washington, D.C., one of the places the Iranian government thought she was conspiring to overthrow their government. The number here is 410-319-8888. You can write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. Log on to our Facebook and put your questions there as well, and we'll let you join this conversation. 410-319-8888. And the women's issue in Iran, I was really very interested in reading what you said about when the Islamic Revolution succeeded in overthrowing the Shah, that the first thing they did was to end women's rights.
Yes, the first thing they did, they suspended the personal status law. You know, in Islamic country, the personal status law is very important because this is the law which gives women the right to seek a divorce, the right of child custody. It regulates the age of marriage. It deals with polygamy. It deals with temporary marriage in Shiite countries. It gives the woman the right to choose her domicile, to leave the house, even if it is for studying, not necessarily working. So the personal status law is very important. And there had been a lot of improvement in pre-revolutionary Iran in the personal status law. The age of marriage was raised first to 15, then to 18, before the Iranian Revolution. But after the revolution, they lowered the age of marriage to 9 because puberty is the age where girls can get can be married off in according to Islamic law. And now it is 13. So, and women could go to court to seek a divorce, and family courts were set up to look into family dispute. These family courts were closed after the revolution. Child custody after the revolution went automatically to men, and women did not have a right this has changed slightly in the last few years. So a court decides to give the custody of the children up to a certain age to the mothers. And so this is very important. And of course, when women saw that suddenly all these rights were taken away from them, they started demonstrating and protesting and writing letters to the then leader of the revolution, Ayatollah Khomeini, and other cleric, because the changes that were that had happened in pre-revolutionary Iran affected mostly the middle class and the less affluent women in the societies. So therefore, they didn't want to lose these rights.
We're going to take a short break and come back and continue our conversation with Hala Esfandiari about her latest book, My Prison, My Home, One Woman's Story of Captivity in Iran. The number here is 410-319-8888. And we'll explore a great deal more with her in the last half hour of this program. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ was formed in 1936 to help people during the Great Depression. And over 70 years later, they're still here to help people during difficult times. More information is available at MECU.com. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the University of Maryland Women's Health for every stage of a woman's life, offering compassionate care and comprehensive obstetric and gynecological services from routine exams to specialized pelvic surgery. More information is available at 1-800-492-5538 or log on to www.umm.edu/Women's Center. We're talking this hour with our guest, Hala Esfandiari, a noted journalist and scholar who's director of the Middle East Program at Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in Washington, D.C. We're talking about her newest book, My Prison, My Home, One Woman's Story of Captivity in Iran. And you remember that story from the news in 2007 when she was held in prison, an American citizen gone to visit her mother. I wanted to ask you about some the kind of questions of that about contradiction about the about Iran before the revolution that overthrew the Shah. And you kind of go through a bit of history of Iran in the beginning of your book. And I remember I interviewed Roya Harkakian, who is an Iranian woman who's Jewish, who wrote a book about her life in Iran. And she talked about how the tolerance of Iran when she grew up in it as a young Jewish woman. But she also talked about her brother who had been arrested by Savak, the Shah's secret police, and how he was tortured and arrested by those police. And at the same time in Iran, women were much freer than they are today. There was more tolerance between different ethnic and religious groups in Iran. But the Shah himself, in many ways, was very oppressive and repressive. And now you have an Iran that was overthrown by that, that is completely repressive to women. But I wonder what you talk about the contradictions you see in the country of your birth like that.
Oppression and excesses and atrocities by the secret police before the revolution is a known fact. It existed, and we have read a lot about it, and we have heard a lot about it. But I think Iran before the revolution was a country that was trying to modernize and was trying to progress. You know, when I look back at my own life, you know, I was born before the revolution and left Iran at the age of, I wasn't yet 40, but under 40. So in those 3.5 decades, Iran had made a lot of progress, especially when it came to women's rights and also to education and access to employment. And even Iran's foreign policy was a very stable foreign policy. Iran had friends in the West and in the East, and it would equally did business with China and Russia and did with European countries and also the Persian Gulf countries. So Iran was considered among the progressive countries in the region. The revolutionaries made a lot of promises, you know. There must have been a reason why the people came out in their tens of thousands and demonstrated against the previous regime because they were unhappy. But I don't think the revolution lived up to its promises. And the expectation of people from the revolution, and I'm not talking about a small group of conservative religious people, I'm talking about people across the board, you know. And I think the expectation was a freer society, a more just society, and a continuation of a progressive modern society. But very few people had paid attention to what Ayatollah Khomeini had said in his sermons and had written in his books. He always talked about an Islamic society, and he wanted to establish an Islamic society, as a society based on Islamic law and jurisprudence. And that's what, at the end, he delivered.
When you look at the future of Iran, before we come back to the heart of your book, and I really do want to explore some of the things you've written about in terms of the things that happened to you in prison and a very compelling human story that you give us. When you see what's going on with what's been called the Green Revolution in Iran now, and the attacks very recently on Mehdi Karoubi, who is the Iranian opposition leader who ran in this election, and the government denying allegations of rape and torture of men and women, rape of men and women in prison that they've arrested since the students that rose up. I wonder what you see happening, because things seem to have died down, maybe because of fear of repression. And I wonder what you make of where Iran is now and what happens to this young movement of people who have stood up, especially the women who led this movement.
I don't think Iran will be the same. I mean, something cracked. The current government lost its legitimacy by manipulating and rigging the elections first and then coming out so viciously into the streets and beating up and arresting people. And then the stories of atrocities, just like you mentioned, what we hear from different prisons and detention centers in Iran. It's very difficult for a government to live with, to regain its credibility after these stories have been circulating. And the stories have not been circulating by the opposition. The stories have been circulating by people like Karoubi and Mir Hossein Mousavi. These are part of the system. Nobody was going to overthrow the regime. They didn't want a revolution. They basically wanted an evolution. And the system was not ready even to accept such a change and evolution. So this time, you know, the accusations are coming from within their own people. Mr. Mousavi was 8 years prime minister. Karoubi was a speaker of parliament. So they are all members of the regime. You know, they were all together in the pre-revolutionary movement, and then they continued after the revolution, and they are the elite. So now they are trying to accuse each other, which means that the revolution no longer speaks with one voice, and we haven't seen the end of it. We most probably will see more revelations, more accusations, probably more sham trials, and then the young will come out again in the streets. I mean, you can't control a population which over more than half of the population is under the age of 30. It's almost impossible to control them.
Well, when you go back at home to visit, when you obviously you're not going to go back anytime soon.
No.
but when you have gone home over the years, what is your sense of that just from your conversations with people that you meet, people of the younger generation, people in a world you might cross when you're visiting your mother?
The younger generation want to be like any other young people around the world. This is what they want. They want freedom. They want freedom of expression. They want freedom of movement. They want to have the choice to dress the way they want. They want to be respected and then respect other people too. I don't think they have a problem with religion per se, as long as religion and state do not mix, and as long as religion does not regulate their daily behavior. What created a change during my visits was the years of President Khatami. All he did was to loosen up the social scene a little bit. You know, girls and boys were no longer harassed. They were not stopped in the streets. They were not picked up because a little bit of the hair was showed, or they were nail polish on their toes and so on. And they could go out together. They could sit in a cafe and so on. They were just, and the access to the internet, to the outside world, that also came to Khatami. They just don't want to be cut off from the rest of the world.
So I wonder, before we go back to where Iran is now, I want to give people another sense of what happened to you when you were sitting in prison. I thought that the stories about what happened to you in that Iranian prison were just so frightening and fascinating. I mean, the guards themselves, the kind of the mixture of response from the guards was really interesting. The woman who gave you the white rose, and the others. Talk about that experience for our listeners.
I was put in and kept in solitary confinement, means in a cell. The lights were on 24 hours a day, and there were two small windows in the ceiling. And at first I slept on one blanket, but I'm a very bony person, so I asked for more blanket, and they gave me 8 blankets, and I used one to keep my books on, one to keep my clothes on, and I slept on 6 blankets with no pillows. And you know, I decided that I cannot succumb to despair. I cannot have the luxury of falling apart. So I decided to remain focused on my interrogation and remember every question they asked me, every answer I gave them, every comment they made. They were very threatening in prison. They threatened me. They said they will keep me for as long as it requires, it needs me to confess to my uncommitted crimes. They would keep me in the country, and they would not see my family the rest of my life, and so on. So I decided that I'm not going to think about my family, because thinking about my husband, my daughter, my grandchildren would really move me to total despair, and I didn't want to do that. And I also, I'm a very disciplined person, so I decided I cannot sit still and just stare in the air. So I arranged for myself, if I was not interrogated, I would just do exercise, pace up and down the cell, do Pilates exercise, use 2 bottles of water as dumbbells, and all these things. So mm-hmm. I kept myself busy. And the women guard would come occasionally. You know, I had to knock on the door, ask them to allow me to go to use the bathroom. And they would bring food in the morning, at noon, and in the evening. I refused to eat prison food, and I lost 20 pounds in 3 months. So when I left prison, I was weighing 85 pounds.
Oh, my goodness.
I was very thin. And just before they freed me, I had decided that I will give myself another 2 weeks and then go on a hunger strike.
And in this also constant interrogation, I think that one of the things that you write about in the book is every time they took you from your cell, they took you out of the building at one point towards the end, that you didn't know what they were really taking you out for, that going through your mind were... they could be at this point, just as they've done to other people, like killing you, throwing you in the desert, murdering you, raping you. Anything could have happened, and those, and they're just living with that day to day. And you talk about steeling yourself. Well, that's a lot to steel yourself against.
Sure, you know, all these things could have happened in prison too. In the 105 days I was in prison, I was taken out of the building only twice, once to appear in front of a magistrate the day after I was arrested, where they gave me a warrant for my stay in prison. And the second time was to go and see my mother, who had gotten the permission to come and see me in prison. So they took me to another building to meet with her. But even in prison, every day when I was taken to interrogation, first of all, I wasn't sure whether there would be the same interrogators. Secondly, I wasn't sure whether I would come out of it alive. Thirdly, I didn't know whether they were not going to move me somewhere else, because at some stage they suggested, they said, well, we can bring in your mother and move the two of you to a house. And I said, absolutely not, you know. I am perfectly happy to be there, because I thought at least here in prison there is a system, they have registered my name, they know I came in, so at least if I disappear, they know I disappeared there. But if they take me to a house, nobody will find out where I am.
I found it interesting, one of the books that you were allowed to have was the Quran, that was written in Persian, in Farsi, yeah. And you could read it. And as a woman who's secular in a sense, I mean, I kept thinking about what happened to you as you read the Quran, stuck in prison with that one book.
Yeah, I think they leave the Quran in every cell, because since then, whenever I've read a memoir or even before that, there is always a copy of the Quran in the cell. I looked at it as a kind of... I thought reading the Quran for me would be informative, and I was educating myself, because I had read the Quran once, you know, just because looking at women's issues in the Quran, the surahs that deal with, the verses that deal with the Quran. But I decided, okay, this is the only book I have here. I might as well study it and study it very carefully. And that's what I did. There are some beautiful verses in the Quran, which I really, as a piece of writing, I enjoyed reading it. And I learned a lot about Islam and the way the Prophet thought. And then I asked for more books, and they said the only books I could get were books from that were in the prison library. And so one of the women guards decided, she said, I'm going to get you books. And she started bringing books on Shi'ism for me. And I thought, oh, my God, no, I have to. I'm going to educate myself on Shi'ism. I was quite familiar with it, you know. I grew up as a Shiite Muslim, and I had studied it. And but the books that were, the level of the books that were there were very childish and primitive. And then at some stage, miraculously, I was allowed to borrow books from another inmate, an Iranian-American, Kian Tajbakhsh, who lived in Iran and was allowed to get books from home. So he would send English books for me. And, you know, that made a big difference, really. I looked forward the whole day to 6 o'clock in the evening or 7 o'clock, we had allocated 2 hours to read books because my eyesight was deteriorating very quickly in jail. And, you know, they denied my eye medicine. So I had a lot of problem. Although I'm an avid reader, I couldn't read more than 2 hours a day in prison.
And you actually, and some of that was your own, the way you describe it, your own self-discipline, where you talk about putting on your unironed but clean T-shirt and these wrinkled cotton pants that you wore, and spending those 2 hours between 6 and 10, sitting down to read between 6 and 10, and just eating a small plate of vegetable and yogurt. I mean, you remained in this whole process. One of the ways you survived was your own self-discipline.
Oh, sure. Two things, I think, helped me. One was not thinking about my real life outside prison, because that would have broken me down. I mean, that really would have, I would have gone to pieces if I was thinking about my husband and my children and my, you know, that was one. And the second thing was to stick to this strict regimen. I mean, I would insist, I didn't have a watch, so the way I found out that I have been 3 months in prison was when the third time I saw the moon through my barred windows, so I knew that I've been kept in prison for 3 months. So I would insist they would wake me up at 6 o'clock in the morning. And after that, I knew that when they brought breakfast, it was 8. When they brought lunch, although I didn't eat their lunch, it was 12. And dinner was sometime between 6 and 7. So, you know, that's how I told the time. And then, of course, when I went to interrogation, the interrogation sometimes took 8 hours, 9 hours. And, you know, I was sitting facing the wall, talking to a concrete wall because I was not allowed to see Haji Aga.
As you kind of, the end of this story really was very strange. When they allowed you out of prison, that story you tell about having to face the wall and I guess it was, if I remember correct, Jafari talking to you and telling you you could go home, soon you'll be able to go home to your mother's house.
You know, they had lied to me so many times in those 3 months, telling me that I'll be able to go home, I'll be able to go home. But the last, you know, when they finally, Haji Aga, it was not Jafari, it was his boss, who called me for interrogation and said, well, you can go home. For a minute, I thought this is yet another of their cruel jokes with me. And I then went back to my cell and told the women's guard that I'm going home. And then one of them came and said, you need a piece of paper, you know, and your release paper. And I said to myself, this is it. You see, they once again, they tried to, you know, fool me or be very cruel to me. But then she went and made a couple of phone calls and she came back and said, yes, you can go home. And of course, I was not released just like this. I mean, they had, my mother had to put her apartment as bail in order to get my release.
And at the very end of this, I mean, two things I mean, just this, that one was kind of very strange and touching. The other was also almost brought tears to my eyes. Well, one was this, the story was Jafari who came and gave you this box at the end before you left, one of your interrogators. That was, talk about that box he gave you and what you think that meant.
The box really contained a book of poetry by Hafez. And so he gave me the book in a box and he said, this is a present from the boys. And I just, if I had the power, I would have just thrown back that box at him. But I'm a very civilized person, so I took the box and I thought to myself, you know, you arrested me. You raided my mother's apartment. You put me through this harrowing experience when I thought every day you might torture me or you might kill me or whatever. And now you say, fine, forget about it. We are friends, and this is our goodbye present for you.
And I to me, being very familiar with Hafez's poetry, that I'm surprised they even read Hafez anymore, some of these
yeah.
men.
Yeah. I wish they had given the book to me in prison.
Right.
I would have enjoyed it much more, Mark, you know.
And again, when you and your mother parted, and I during the whole book, I kept saying to myself, why is your mother not in America? Why is she still in Tehran? She's Austrian. She's Iranian now, of course, but all born in Austria, and didn't go home with you. And you didn't want her, didn't want you to fight for her. That was to go home with you. That was pretty heart-wrenching, but a very powerful piece of the story, I think.
Mother had promised my father when she married him that she would stay faithful to him and to his country. So she always wanted to die in Iran and to be buried next to him. And my sister and I even suggested and gave her our word that no matter where she dies, we will take her back to Iran and bury her next to my father. But she said no. She wants home for her was Iran. And she passed away 3 months ago.
That must have been very hard.
Sure.
But at least she's at peace now.
Yes. At least she doesn't have to worry that they will come and take her apartment and all these things. And she's at peace because I'm out, my sister is out, and we managed to see her in Vienna a week before she passed away. So it was fun.
That's lovely. And I in your epilogue, you talk about even the nightmares you still have about Ervin and how it still affects you. And I guess it has to. And I mean, it's almost like, in some sense, like an experience like PTSD, you know, really, to have gone went through, and back home in Potomac, and all the contradictions that erupt from that.
You know, sometimes at 5:30 in the morning, when the birds start singing outside my window outside our home, I suddenly wake up thinking that I'm in Evin. And I'm still in that cell because I could hear the birds also around 5:30 or 6 in the morning. You know, you can never forget an experience of being a prisoner. This will always stay with you. But then, as I said, I'm a disciplined person. I didn't give in to despair in prison, and I don't want to, you know, look back and relive that horrible period. I'm just looking forward. But what I learned in prison is that you learn to cherish and appreciate freedom and living in a country where the rule of law is dominant.
This has been a real pleasure to speak to you. I've been looking forward to this for a long time. Hala Esfandiari has been our guest. The book, My Prison, My Home, One Woman's Story of Captivity in Iran. You're going to have all the links on our website, steinershow.org. And I encourage you to read this book. And thank you so much. I look forward to one day to talk to you again, but we can talk about policy and the future of Iran and America.
Sure. Thank you very much, Mark.
Thank you.
It was wonderful talking to you.
The same here. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We'll be back in just a minute. When we do return, we'll be talking with Ben Jealous, who is president of the NAACP, and Gerald Torres, a professor at the University of Texas School of Law, for a very interesting conversation, so stay with us for that. I want to remind you to be sure to get your tickets to WEAA's first homecoming cruise. Join us for a night of fun and games at WEAA's Cotton Club Casino Fun Night Cruise aboard the Spirit of Baltimore. Thursday, October the 8th, we'll sail from the historic Inner Harbor from 7 to 10 p.m., Your ticket price includes dinner and a special performance from the soulful jazz vocalist Gene Karn. A portion of your ticket will benefit WEAA, so don't miss the boat. Tickets are available by calling 410-727-3113 or 1-800-695-BOAT. That's 1-800-695-2628. Or go online at weaa.org. Join the cruise. Just stay on the boat once you get there. We'll be right back.